from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on this morning's forum in our opening hour, last year was the driest year on record in California, and not much rainfall is expected in the near future. Leading lawmakers and farmers in the San Joaquin Valley are calling on Governor Jerry Brown to officially declare a drought, which would trigger conservation measures. We'll discuss the implications of drought conditions and what should be done. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Should Governor Jerry Brown declare California in a state of emergency drought? This is one of the state's driest winters, perhaps its most dry, and it's the second dry year in a row with long-term forecasts predicting dryness will continue. The results? The Sierra Nevada snowpacks are only at 20%, and snowpacks through rivers are running low. Low water storage and low soil moisture, failure of wells, and much greater stress on aquifers, and effect on wildlife, agriculture, tourism, food prices, and firefighting, just to name some of the ongoing concerns. The governor created a drought task force, which is meeting weekly and is presently considering a formal declaration of drought emergency. In this morning's opening forum hour, we want to focus on California's parched water supplies. I ought to add a historical footnote here because not all of you have the institutional memory or the historical memory, especially young listeners, but back in 1977 when Jerry Brown was first governor, he actually called for 25% reduction statewide in personal water use and went to Washington to press for aid. He, some old-timers may remember, had a pitcher of water that he replaced with a single cup of water at a news conference, and that was quite symbolic. In fact, let's hear a cut from Governor Brown before we begin.
I'm very aware of the problems of the drought. We had another one in 1977 that I had to deal with, and we'll take whatever steps we can. But don't think that a paper from the governor's office is going to affect the rain.
Well, let me tell you who is joining us to talk about what's going to affect the rain or what is up ahead in terms of water rationing, perhaps, or a drought emergency if it comes to that. Jeff Mount is here in studio. He's Emeritus Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis, Founding Director of UC Davis's Center for Watershed Sciences. Jeff Mount, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
We also have Chris Brown with us by phone this morning, Director of California Urban Water Conservation Council. Chris Brown, welcome to Forum.
Thanks.
And we also want to welcome Karen Ross, who is Secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture, and she will be with us shortly in the course of the hour. But let me begin with Jeff Mount here in studio. Well, I guess this is an ongoing meteorological drama, as you phrased it, but let's get right to the point here. Should we declare a drought? And if so, why? And if not, would it be perhaps premature to do so?
Well, drought is in the eye of the beholder. That's the bottom line about drought. Drought has various definitions. By meteorological standards, we're solidly in a drought. I mean, this would be ignoring the obvious. Soil moisture is the lowest we've ever recorded here. This is the most extended period of lack of precipitation, and it's statewide. It's dramatic. Usually our wet north coast is very, very, very dry. This year, record dry. And we broke records for dryness, not just by a few inches, but by like 50%. So we're in a drought. There's no doubt about it. But the question of declaring one is much more political than meteorological. And that's the challenge the governor faces in deciding whether or not to declare a drought.
It's political for a number of reasons, but largely because it's bad for business, right?
In fact, I think that's what most people worry about. Number one is California, the Center for Natural Disasters. But the second aspect of this is that we have various levels of preparation for drought around the country, and I'm pretty sure we're going to get into that. I mean, around the state. We're going to get into that today in your discussion. When we hear about metropolitan water districts, they're doing fine in Southern California. They're not going to have shortages of water down in Southern California. And places of normally water-rich, like on the American River, the little town of Folsom, for example, are in a full-blown crisis. So it's mixed. And declaring a statewide drought emergency when you don't have an emergency in a number of places is politically problematic as well.
Well, also, though, if you do declare a drought, it brings attention to the feds for relief, and it also mobilizes, presumably, the public. I mean, that would be the biggest reason, presumably.
Yeah. Now, the Fed is already engaged. This is they have already declared drought disaster areas.
They're actually forcing to take water from the east side and send it to the west side growers at this point.
And that's going to be a real interesting dynamic as we watch what happens.
But it brings more to bear in terms of federal help.
Yes, it does. And it's already here. It's already available. And there will be more to come associated with this. So I'm not too worried about that. The question I would ask you and your listeners and certainly the folks in the administration is how much power the governor actually has. It's not very well spelled out in the California Water Code what the powers of the governor are. So this is going to be interesting to watch it unfold.
Well, Senator Feinstein and other state lawmakers are urging a declaration of an emergency. So are San Joaquin Valley growers. And Chris Brown, where do you stand on this from the conservation point of view?
I think it's very helpful to have the governor step up. He has a bully pulpit, as we know. And that sends a message out to the entire state. In past droughts, not only here in California, but around the country, many times communities have gotten to situations similar to Folsom's, and they actually need the help of their neighbors. And having a statewide declaration puts everybody on notice that people may get to a point of crisis and actually need to do some things emergency-wise in terms of transferring water, having special ways of delivering water to folks, but also justifying for a local water agency measures that might say there is no outdoor irrigation anymore, that essentially putting water on plants while we have this little water available to the entire community is not appropriate. Water needs to be saved for human needs. So having that message go out statewide gives everyone who, especially those who are in more of a crisis, room in which to maneuver to say, hey, our neighbors are suffering, and this has happened here in California, putting temporary pipelines over the San Rafael Bridge. It's happened in other states, building temporary pipelines from one city to another. Those kind of things happen when everybody realizes we're all in it together.
Well, there probably, I remember back again going to what we started with here and hearing Governor Brown and hearing him recall back in the 70s. People weren't flushing toilets back then. I mean, there were water options given to you in restaurants, lawn watering on certain days. In other words, all the sorts of things that we would associate with certain times to wash cars with conservation, they seem to be kind of forgotten, really. And why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think there is a habit with the behavioral measures where you change what you do, that if the sense of crisis goes away, and we've had a long period here between the last really big drought in California in the early 90s and the more recent dry periods of the last few years, and people have forgotten that they can do things on a regular basis to reduce their water use. People who live off the grid, however, have shown us that the average person can get by on 30 to 35 gallons per person per day. And so there's a lot of room for people to reduce their use, to find ways to fit within whatever the water supply is available to them. I think it's just absence of mind. It has been a long time since California has had a multi-year drought where we've been challenged like we're being challenged right now.
Well, you mentioned 30 to 35 gallons. I mean, I was astonished to find out from figures that you gave us that per person per day in California is up to 150 gallons. That just seems extraordinary, even in light of the fact that in California we use three times as much water, say, on the average per person as they use in Australia, and that's pretty dry down there.
Right. Australia went through a 14-year drought, and they really ratcheted down, got their average use down to around 50 gallons per person per day in the urban areas, which really shows that even if you're not off the grid, people can get a lot more efficient. We've kind of grown used to watering lawns that really wouldn't have ever grown in California naturally, and people just expect to have a certain look. They don't. Our landscapes in our cities do not look like the landscape outside the city boundaries, which grows naturally, and that takes a lot of water.
Let me bring Karen Ross into this. She's Secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture. And Karen Ross, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning to you. There's a lot of tension, and we'll talk about this also with Jeff Mahon, who's here with us, and Chris Brown. But I want to get your take about just the tension that's existing now between the urban sectors and the agricultural sectors, because there are larger water districts that are more reliable as water sources than the agricultural. And the agricultural, well, from your perspective, I imagine, are suffering right now. That's a strong word to use, but it's true, isn't it?
Well, we're seeing that, and it's very widespread because of the extremely dry conditions this year, and the fact that our agricultural landscape has changed dramatically over the last couple of decades to many more acres of permanent crops. They're very efficiently watered, but the fact is when you make that investment for a minimum of 25 years, you have to keep water going to those trees and vines.
And overall, the farmers, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley, the San Joaquin Valley growers are urging, as I said, for a declaration of emergency. How premature is this, or how necessary is this as you see it?
Well, the declaration itself doesn't create more water, so we all have to be realistic and manage the expectations about that. But what we're preparing for the governor is a very succinct list of what it can do with regard to providing more flexibility in the system for our water managers, who have to balance a number of beneficial uses to make sure that every drop is used in the best way possible to meet all the needs and demands that we have on the limited water supply that's available.
Well, I'm not making a brief for it here, but the declaration wouldn't necessarily create water or money, but it would allow the governor to direct certain funds, typically unspent in water bond funds, right?
Of what's left of that, that is one aspect. But what we're really focused on right now is how do we create more flexibility in the demands on the system to meet upstream flows, outflows, and all the beneficial uses.
Well, the government can also, governor can also, as I understand it, lift environmental protections that would help out the Bay Estuary and allow water transfers. So that's really what we're talking about, is perhaps being necessary to help.
Well, it's not even water transfers. It's really about balancing upstream flows, downstream flows, and balancing those environmental demands at every end of the water supply. The fact is, this is going to have impact on pretty much a statewide basis.
Well, we're seeing voluntary conservation at this point and rebates passed by local legislative bodies. In fact, in Mendocino County, they've declared a drought emergency. In the near future, Governor Brown doesn't declare the state in drought emergency. Probably, as Jeff Mahon indicated earlier, we're going to see more and more things happening locally, aren't we?
Well, we absolutely. California is not in a position to be frivolous with any drop of water. So we have to double down on conservation. We have to make the investments in recycling and be more innovative in recycling. We need to look at small-scale regional opportunities for storage, especially groundwater banking. But the fact is, groundwater banking, which has huge capacity to help store water, doesn't work without the availability of surface water. Every person in California needs to have a strong conservation ethic when it comes to the use of water.
Karen Ross with us again as Secretary of California Department of Food and Agriculture. And Secretary Ross, could you just give us an idea of the vulnerability of these farm communities, which we really need to focus on?
Well, we do, and based on 2009, which was really more of a specific geographic region that was impacted, we know that we have at stake hundreds of millions of dollars of productivity that will be lost. Most of the fallowing that will happen will be on annual crops, meaning melons or vegetables or other kinds of row crops, and that's where a lot of the job losses will be. Those job losses tend to come in the Central Valley, where we have high unemployment currently, and those seasonal jobs are very important to those families. Based on 2009, we saw a huge increased demand for food through the food banks, and food banks were very stressed. So that's part of our planning now, is to make sure that food is available for these families, continued assistance with unemployment and how to re-employ people and other aspects. But the impact to rural communities cannot be overlooked because it is community-wide. It impacts schools. It impacts juvenile delinquency. It impacts crime. So we're very mindful of that in the planning that we're doing.
Yeah, well, certainly we need to be mindful of that. And also, although food is much more important in many people's minds than wine, there's a whole wine industry to the north of us here in San Francisco, and there's concern about nothing short of ecological disaster up there.
Well, clearly, the impact to Sonoma and Mendocino County, we're already starting to see some of that, as well as San Luis Obispo County, where there's been a thriving wine industry. Those jobs, those export jobs where wine has really become very popular, are jobs that happen in ports and in many urban areas. So this is an area where we see the strong connection between rural and urban California.
Could you say something, Secretary Ross, about what might happen in the wake of what we're experiencing now to the $11.1 billion bond that's been put, water bond that's been put forward, as well as Governor Brown's $25 billion plan to build two tunnels to direct water around the Delta, which we spoke about here on Forum?
Well, certainly those are big issues with regard to the public policy arena and some of the politics that will happen about that. I think it's safe to say that the current conditions will certainly remind every Californian about the importance of water, our dependence upon water. It also provides us an opportunity not just about what's going on in the short term, but to think about how we've benefited from the investments that previous generations made that we are benefiting from today, and that we have an opportunity and a responsibility to make equal investments to ensure the ongoing vitality of California.
Once again, Karen Ross is Secretary of California's Department of Food and Agriculture. Secretary Ross, thank you for being with us on Forum.
I appreciate the opportunity, Michael.
Appreciate your being with us. And also with us this morning is Richard Harris, who's manager of water conservation for East Bay Mud, the municipal utility district, on the phone with us. And Richard Harris, good to have you aboard. Hi.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about this pilot program you have that's aimed at conservation, really aimed at changing behavior.
Yes, for about the last year, we partnered with the California Water Foundation and WaterSmart Software to develop what we call a behavior water efficiency program, where we took a much more user-friendly approach to our typical water bill and delivered customized information for residential households that would share with them where their water use was, how they would compare to similar size households or neighborhoods, and how they would compare to an efficient home that might have been recently built or upgraded with new plumbing fixtures, appliances, and low water use landscaping. And as some of your guests have said, there's various ranges where people have an awareness of their water use and how efficient they can be. And this is really just an opportunity to give them information, because our customers don't want to waste water, but they typically don't have an awareness of exactly how much they use. They typically know how much their water bill is, but this helps them benchmark some opportunities to save even more.
Well, back to Jeff Mount's point earlier, though, about some districts doing better. The East Bay doing better now, huh?
Well, we're fortunate that we ended last year pretty well, and our customers have continued to be conservation-minded. We have a program that is a year-round message and education on using water wisely. And so its storage is really the key thing here, and we started off this year with a little better storage. But we are experiencing the record dry dryness in our watershed, as others are, and we have mobilized our internal team and to really look at what's going to happen here in the coming months in the spring, and if it's a repeat of what we've seen for the past year and drier springs in the past, we're likely going to be looking at implementing some additional education and additional measures.
Well, much appreciate your being with us here on Forum, and wish you continued success with this. Again, Richard Harris is manager of water conservation, for East Bay Mud, the municipal utility district, and appreciate, again, your being with us, Richard Harris. Let me go back to Jeff Mount. A lot of this is planning, as we've been able to extrapolate from what you've said and from what Richard Harris just said. But looking, for example, comment on Facebook from a listener named Jessica: what is causing the drought? We don't have La Nina presently. What do meteorologists think is going on? Well, a lot of this is climate change, isn't it?
Okay, so you want to be very careful, and you've heard this on your show many times, for ascribing a given weather phenomenon to climate change. Many of the models...
Big contributor, though, isn't it?
Well, many of the models suggest that some atmospheric forcing may be responsible for this. But I have to tell you, this is unprecedented. When you look at how resistant this ridge, this high-pressure ridge that has settled in on us for now more than a year, which is extremely unusual, and is sitting right on top of us, it actually kind of defies the... We don't have the resolution in the climate models to really say that this is associated with climate change. It is consistent with what the models suggest, the kind of changes that are going on. And in fact, I mean, this is what we've heard from time and again from the climate modelers, is that what we're going to see is a change in the magnitude and frequency of extreme events like this. And this is so when we think the future in California, this sort of boom-bust cycles that we have in California are just likely to be amplified. And this might be a window into what we would see in the future. But remember, droughts are ephemeral. They come and go. There will be a wet following this. Steinbeck reminded us that during the wet, we forget the dry, and during the dry, we forget the wet, and it has always been so. Steinbeck was correct all the way back then.
Just like economics, boom and bust.
Yes, right.
And let me go back, if I may, to you, Chris Brown. Chris Brown again directs California's Urban Water Conservation Council. When we're talking about management here and the future of water in California, we have to talk about managing surface water and groundwater together, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the challenges that Californians have is that we don't have in place a groundwater law that basically requires everybody to show how much groundwater they're using. And we've seen some issues with that over the last few years. Studies of satellite data show that we're depleting our groundwater resources. In previous dry times, many agencies moved to conjunctive use. They just moved from surface water supplies that were stressed by droughts to using more groundwater. If we're using up the groundwater resources, that's not going to be a strategy that's available. So this is going to be a challenge for some communities in California. Clearly, California is a very diverse environment where you have deep groundwater basins in the Central Valley and other valleys around the state, but not so much in some areas. Like San Diego doesn't have a lot of groundwater resources, so they've had to diversify their supply in different ways. So each local community has a different diverse water supply, a mix of reservoirs, groundwater, in-stream flow. And we can see, and I've talked about earlier on the show, the challenges to a city like Folsom that's on the American River would be expecting water to be flowing by right now, but the reservoir is less than 20% capacity. They're facing a challenge they haven't faced before. There are going to be different challenges in different parts of the state, and everybody has their own particular plan for how to manage that. The state did, having gone through the drought of the 1970s, recognize the fact that for a state as a whole, each one of these communities needs to plan for the future, both long-term conservation on a regular basis and for drought crises. And so all the larger cities prepare plans for these kind of periods. But in many ways, what we've talked about earlier, this is unprecedented, this particular dry period. And so we may find that some of those plans are not quite up to the challenges.
Well, let me take this opportunity to invite listeners to join the conversation. In fact, we welcome your involvement, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your call, so feel free to call us now. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. And if you have questions or comments, you can add your voice in other ways by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page, talking with Chris Brown from the Urban Water Conservation Council and Jeff Mount, who's professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis, and you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. Last year was the driest year on record for the state of California. Not much rainfall is expected in the near future. And leading lawmakers and farmers, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley, are calling on Governor Brown to officially declare a drought, which would trigger conservation measures. And we're talking about the implications of drought conditions and what should be done and what can be done, not only in the short term, but the long term. Just talking with Jeff Mount a little bit off air here about some of the more scary economic scenarios that may result from what we're, I mean, if things continue to be as dry as they are. And Jeff Mann, again, is Emeritus Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis and founding director of UC Davis's Center for Watershed Sciences. You want to say something a little more about that, Jeff?
Well, so on the economic side of drought, what we know from previous droughts is the economic costs tend to be local. And those are the areas, particularly agricultural areas, that we heard from one of your earlier discussers. Those tend to get hit the hardest. But statewide, when you look at drought, the cost of drought, it tends to not be as dramatic economically as one would think. There is the impact on business overall and perceptions about California. But I want to remind you that the vast majority of water that's used in California goes to agriculture. I mean, 80% of the consumptive use of water is agriculture. And that's, according to a recent PPIC study on water in the economy, that's about 2.5% of the GDP of California. So the main effect is going to be in the agricultural sector. It's going to hurt locally.
Locally. The food from the agricultural sector goes all over the country.
In fact, it makes our food more expensive. And this is where
it brings up food costs. Exactly.
Yeah, it makes our food more expensive. But again, as a $2 trillion economy, we can absorb those sort of changes fairly well when you look at it at the very, very large scale. But it's a major blow to local economies.
Well, again, I want to bring our listeners into this, and you can join us toll-free if you have questions or comments. The number to call is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And before I bring listeners in, I wanted to bring Sean Lawrence, who is general manager of the San Juan Water District. They're asking customers to stop all outdoor watering and to cut consumption by 20%. And Sean Lawrence, welcome. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello there. So you made this decision, and what does it entail exactly, and what kind of compliance do you think you're going to get?
Well, at this point, it's an educational process. There is relatively low need for irrigation at this point. One day a week would be considered adequate, so slightly stressing by not irrigating at all isn't going to cause permanent damage on landscape, but Possum Lake is so low that if conditions stay as they are, the lake's projected to drop below our intake sometime this summer. So based on that, there's a necessity to store as much water as we can behind the lake and to gear up for emergency conditions, which is obviously a much lower flow.
How do you come to the figure 20%? Because that's always the figure that seems to be agreed upon. They're talking about not with agriculture, but if we get into – maybe we'll find out more about this from Chris Brown. But you get to that 20% in terms of volume pricing and all kinds of things. Why did you decide on that?
Well, at this point, it's a request because it's a 20% kind of on an annual basis because most reductions are done by outside irrigation, not through indoor use at this point. Most indoor use is hardened. You know, we've met all the best management practices. All the toilets are replaced. Everything's been done related to those activities. 20% is usually kind of a number that gets people aware. I think the bigger thing for us is as Folsom continues to drop and assuming the forecast remains dry, we are very likely to go to no outdoor irrigation and a request for a 50% reduction.
Well, you're talking about roughly how many people in your population area?
Well, within San Juan, Roseville, and Folsom, which is kind of the area served from Folsom Lake at the same location, there's about 500,000 people impacted.
And you're doing what to get this voluntary compliance exactly, other than putting the word out through the media and the like?
Correct. We have stuff on website. I think I'm speaking to every known group out there in the region. And we're getting a lot of phone calls. We are lucky to serve an area where most people do go forward with the request. Most people have seen Folsom Lake. They know what the issue is. And I anticipate that we're going to get not everybody, but the majority of the people are going to work very hard to help out in this situation.
Well, good luck. And thank you for joining us this morning on Forum.
Thank you very much.
Shauna Lawrence, who is general manager of the San Juan Water District. They are asking customers to stop all outdoor watering and to cut their consumption of water by 20%. And let me go to your phone calls, and we begin with Linda. Good morning. You're on.
Oh, good morning. I have a question that may sound like I'm an idiot, but I think that your numbers, when you say 30 to 35 gallons of water is really low water use, and we're doing like 150 gallons per person now. I can't imagine how I am using either one of those figures, and I would like somebody to kind of explain how those figures are calculated.
That's a fair question. Doesn't make you sound like an idiot at all. I have the same question in my head, and so do probably lots of listeners. And Chris Brown, can you help elucidate?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, the 30 to 35 gallons comes out of studies that were done on people, basically households that live on rainwater. They catch the rainwater off their roof, put it in a cistern, survive on that water year-round. There's not a lot of that here in California. There's some along the coastal area. But in the central part of the U.S., Texas, Ohio, there's quite a bit of that going on. So those studies happened around rural communities where it's hard rock, really deep to groundwater, no rivers nearby, and so people subsist on the water they can capture from Mother Nature. And as for the average use in communities, there's basically been a number of studies in California that show that overall the usage by a municipality, when you take all water uses divided by the total population, in the 2005 arena was around 190 gallons per person per day. Now, that includes commercial and industrial use, which represents in some communities from 10 to 25% of the water use. And essentially, you know, you take that part out of the larger use and you have, you know, the average households using somewhere around that. Now, obviously, if you're a very conserving person and you are paying attention to your water use, you're not going to be using anywhere near 150 gallons per person per day. And in fact, if you look at statistics of people's water bills, you'll find that that average really represents a coming together of people who are very efficient on one end of the scale and people who clearly are watering a lot or maybe have a leak on the other end of the scale. So finding that average person that actually uses that is probably pretty hard. It's more likely that what we're talking about in these kind of numbers are the law of averages. When you look at people who use a lot of water on their lawns, average with people who use very little, you fall right around there in terms of the numbers.
And let me thank Linda for her call and go to more of your calls. Let me bring Stan on. Stan, you're on. Hi.
Yeah, hi. It's Stan in Mountain View. And I've been listening to your expert talk about an unprecedented drought, when in fact California is a desert, and we've had an unprecedented wet for the past 100 years, which has helped encourage everybody to use water.
Jeff Mount.
Okay, so we've only been keeping records, good records, for more than about 100 years, 120 years, but we have records that go back actually a couple hundred years here in California. We had a drought in the 1860s, which was a statewide drought, which was quite dramatic. But even that does not match, as far as we can tell, what we're seeing right now. So from the time we really occupied California extensively, starting in the mid-1800s to the present, we haven't had anything like it. Now, you're right. On one hand, we're coming out of a broad wet. There's a long period of time where California has been very, very wet, and we may be trending toward our new normal, which is drier. But we don't know, and we won't know until we're through it.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll go to more calls in a moment. I want to read some web comments. One listener writes, global warming means more uncertain weather for California, so we may be experiencing the new normal, including a less certain water supply, yet the state legislature has ordered Bay Area cities to increase their populations substantially, turning towns into mini Manhattans along their main corridors. This is yet another example of the state government considering issues in isolation without considering the broader consequences, and one of which is obviously going to be strict water rationing and the elimination of lawns and fountains. Another listener asks, if Northern California is in critical water shortage and Southern California is not, would it be possible to divert some of the water being sent south to help relieve the situation? It's an unusual thought. It's usually the other way that water's going, isn't it? And here's Paul who writes on Facebook, why don't we use some of this California budget windfall to actually try to do something to increase water storage or access to other state water systems that do have rain instead of just sitting around like a chicken with its head cut off? Another listener, Arthur, says fracking uses a lot of water. To what extent does the drought interact with the water used by fracking? And to what extent can fracking fluid returning to surface, perhaps with formation water, contaminate water supplies? Well, you want to take that on for us, maybe, Chris Brown?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not an expert in fracking, but yeah, any time that you use toxic chemicals in proximity to drinking water, you run a risk. Clearly, the people who are proponents of it claim that they're doing everything they can to protect the wells, but we've seen through documentaries that it doesn't always work. So it's a great question. I don't have a lot of data about that, but it's a risk that, looking long-term, one really ought to ask yourself about California in view of what Professor Mount was talking about. We may be entering a new normal. Certainly the climate models suggest that change is with us and it's going to continue into the future. It's unlikely that we're going to see a continuation of what your listener called this long, wet period.
I want to read an email from a listener named Paul who says, having grown up in Australia, the lack of public discourse on water before reaching emergency levels is shocking. At 40%, we should have been talking about how to reduce water usage through basic steps such as showering with other family members, putting a bucket in the shower to collect water for the garden, or flushing the toilet manually, and, of course, only flushing solids. Still amazes me that single-flush toilets are available, let alone the default. Simple measures, such as requiring all new toilets to be dual-flush, save thousands of liters per household per year. Why did we wait until an emergency before having the discussion and putting in sensible steps to reduce water usage? How do you read that, Jeff Mount?
Well, I do want to remind him that when you look at the overall water picture, that's pretty small. I also want to remind him something we haven't said today. The long-term trend is very good. We have seen a steady decline in per capita consumption of water. We've seen a steady decline in agricultural consumption of water. We are becoming a much more water-efficient state, and we should be applauding that. But those changes are incremental. They don't take place overnight. They don't take place associated with a drought emergency. They're just long-term evolving changes. As water's getting more expensive and more scarce, we're adjusting to it. So I'm actually a little more optimistic than perhaps many of your listeners that we are evolving and changing our patterns. And this is particularly true in Southern California, where they've really developed reuse, recycling. They're trying to do a desal plant. They're not being very successful at it. But they really are diversifying their water portfolios, which is the single smartest hedge you can have against drought and declining amounts of water. So I actually am pretty impressed with what's going on in California.
Do you share that optimism, Chris Brown?
Yeah, I agree with his statement about basic conservation measures and equipment indoors. Toilets, for example, now it's only legal to put in a high-efficiency toilet in California. And if you make any retrofit to a home that requires you to get a building permit, you have to change out all the toilets, even if you're not converting your bathroom. So as a society as a whole, we're moving to more and more efficient equipment. However, the challenge during a drought is that you got to get the behavior to match the equipment. And there's still a lot of room with the way we behave in terms of putting water outdoors. Most of the studies show that in California communities, anywhere from 50 to as high as 80% of the water used on a municipal basis is outdoors. And that has – the plants have nothing to do with that at the end of the day, because some human being turns on the faucet, turns on the spigot, turns on the irrigation system, and we have control of that. And that's the challenge for the future, is becoming much more efficient about irrigating. And quite frankly, if we are going to continue to see growing population, reduced water availability, we're going to have to start making different choices in landscape material in order to have landscapes that fit with our climate, that when we have droughts, they're less likely to die off, and they use less water year-round.
Again, Chris Brown is director of California Urban Water Conservation Council, and Clay is our next caller. Clay, join us. Hi.
Yes, thank you. Currently, I'm in San Jose, but I live in the foothills east of Sacramento, but I drive close to 6,000 miles a month all through the valley and the Bay Area, and constantly I'm seeing these open agricultural canals that are moving water from one point to another. I know for a fact that moving water evaporates faster than water sitting still in a puddle or a lake. Why can't we, I'm tired of the agricultural people saying, we don't have enough water, we don't have enough water. Yes, they have made efforts at using less water at the source, at the plant. But what about the movement of that water? Can we cover those? What is the economic feasibility of being more efficient with our water transportation.
Yeah, Jeff Ma.
So that's actually ongoing as we speak. In some areas, they're lining these canals. They used to lose a tremendous amount of water from these canals. There has been lots of talk about covering canals, including the very, very large, the Delta Mendota Canal and the California Aqueduct. And my colleagues have done some basic calculations on this, and it might not be cost effective. That's the bottom line, because in the bottom line, does it make sense economically to do this so that the amount of water that you lose to the atmosphere is worth the cost of covering it? And right now it's not. And what we need there is a higher price of water to force that kind of conservation.
Well, speaking about higher price of water, and Chris Brown, let me direct this to you. We've got an email here from a listener named Ilum who says rationing water may be too drastic, but how about pricing? Laws of economics say that when supply goes down, price increases. How about changing behavior through pricing? It may work more effectively than just telling people there isn't enough water.
Well, that does work, and there are communities here in California that have that as part of their drought plan. They have drought surcharges. They also may have penalties for people who water on days they're not supposed to water. So pricing is part of the drought response that many communities in California use.
Let me go to a Petaluma caller, and Dick, that's you. Thanks for waiting. Join us on forum. Good morning.
Hi. I was wondering if now might be a really good time to assess all the federal and state water contracts. It's my understanding we offer and promise 4 times the amount of water we ever have in California available, even in a wet year. And my other question is it time to build another 2 or 3 San Luis reservoirs and, like the previous caller, figure out some benign environmental way to cover those up to get rid of the evaporation? And if we're going to have less snowfall and more rainfall, we got to catch that water when we can. So thanks for your seminar. This is great.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Jeff Mound.
So it's really 2 questions,
yes,
and both are being asked a lot. First of all, there is this notion that we've overpromised water, and this has been a big deal in the debate around the Delta. I remind all of you that those contracts that the federal government and the state government have particularly for the farmers and metropolitan water district, there's no guarantee that they will deliver on those contracts. And this year alone, DWR is talking about delivering 5% on the contracts. So we've overpromised something that doesn't exist, but we don't actually promise to deliver it, which I think is a big difference. On the second thing on storage, that is going to be topic front and center after the drought is over and during the drought. And Michael, you may want to devote a whole session to the issue of storage.
It's a big issue. Yeah.
It is a huge issue. Storage is expensive, and adding storage only works in 2 cases. One is if you can fill it, and right now extra storage wouldn't be any good because we can't fill it. And two, whether you can afford it. And that's where it gets sticky with storage. It's always good if somebody else pays for it. But if you have to pay for it, it's going to be darned expensive, and you may not like it.
A question, Chris Brown, from a listener who wants to know what the drought means for the trees in the state forests and wildlands. He says that's what he worries about.
Oh, absolutely. There's going to be a lot of die-off or damage to native landscape throughout the state. There's no way around that. Long dry periods do have an impact on our native wildlife and flora and fauna both. However, you can look back to some of the older trees that grow in the southwest of the United States, and it's pretty clear that we've had long dry periods. So most of these plants actually have survival strategies. They close their stomata, the little holes through which photosynthesis and the loss of water happens, and they basically shut down and go dormant. So many of them will survive, but there's no question that they become more vulnerable to pests and insects and other diseases, and that there will be die-off from a drought.
Let me follow up just with a couple of other emails with you, Chris. They're kind of tied together. One listener, and then Michael, for example, emails a question about percentage of per capita water consumption, industrial versus personal household, because all efforts, he points out, seem to be focused on personal use. And then I've got a tweet here from a listener named Chad who says, should conservation measures be applied to industry? Seems consumers are a relative drop in the bucket compared to ag and industry.
Well, there are a lot of efforts being made with industry. When you talked earlier about the fact of not serving water in a restaurant, well, restaurants are an example of a type of water use where there's many common uses, but that's unusual in industrial use. For example, if you went to a winery versus a cannery versus a clothes manufacturer, you would find different kinds of uses. So the strategies that they use to reduce water use in those kind of processes are of necessity specific to the type of process that the water is being used for. And many times those businesses during a drought see, well, wait a second. I mean, long term, the viability of my successful business is dependent on water, and I need to be more efficient about it because I want to stay in business. And so they actually do take steps to try to reduce their water use. But they're oftentimes very expensive steps. They'll do internal recycling of water. They'll filter and reuse water in those kind of processes. And they're not the kind of measures that you can apply across the board like you could to a restaurant or to homeowners that own lawns, where you say everybody needs to cut back on their irrigation of their lawn. So in terms of enforcing a drought program on your entire community, it's much easier to set up some rules that you say, okay, these apply to everybody who uses water in common ways. For these other unique uses, it's oftentimes requires that the water agency work more directly, and there are initiatives happening. East Bay Mud is a good example. Richard Harris was on. They have worked directly with some of their big industrial users, but that's happening around California. It's just slower, and it's out of the public eye because we can't set one set of rules for all types of businesses, all types, especially industrial customers.
Well, apropos of that, looking at an email from a listener named Mary who says outdoor watering is for more than just watering lawns. I have a food-producing backyard garden, almost no lawn. That's where my outdoor water use goes. It's very misleading that you keep mentioning watering lawns as if that was the only thing people water in their yards. Fair enough, Mary. Thank you for that point. And let me get another caller on. Dale, that's you. Hi.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be as brief as possible. I'm a duck hunter, so hunting in the rice fields, I pay attention to the amount of water, the intensive amount of water it takes to grow rice, and the majority of it gets exported. That kind of got my hackles up until I started looking into it a little bit further, and there's an international impact to cutting back on water in those rice fields because of migratory birds. They need those wetlands. And if we cut back on the rice, we cut back on the wetlands, and we're going to upset the migratory bird patterns. So what about that?
What about that, Jeff Ma?
He's got a good point. Over the years, we've really grown to understand how important rice is, particularly in the Sacramento River area, Sacramento floodplains, for sustaining the Pacific Flyway. This is really important. And heck, now we're even talking about using those rice fields to grow salmon. So this is one of the impacts we're not going to talk much about because we're going to focus on our lawns. But in fact, this will be an unfolding ecological disaster as well as for some communities an economic disaster. And I think this gets lost in the conversation. And there's nothing in the water code that tells us we have to face up to it. It's a matter of policy, and we've heard very positive policies being mentioned out of the current administration as they look at it. But this is really going to be important, and the place is really going to hit home is when we're dealing with fish.
We're going to talk about, we haven't even talked about this, but we could do a whole hour on this, effect of rivers and streams, which I know comes under your purview and a lot of the work you've done on the whole, really, when you think about it, not only ecosystem, but the Delta ecosystem specifically.
Yeah. I mean, so most directly, fish and the declining fish, native fish species in California is driving issues of water management in California. It's probably beyond demand, it's probably the single most greatest driver. And if we ignore that, we ignore it at our peril. The federal government will probably step in and not let us ignore it, but it's extremely important as this drought unfolds.
Another listener, John, writes, there have been several mentions of balancing the water needs of California's agriculture, the general public, and the environment, but there's been no mention that this allocation has not been balanced for several decades. For fish and wildlife in the Bay Delta, more than a third of years in the past 45 have felt like a very severe drought. This year they will receive a smaller proportional share than ever.
Yeah, and that's a good point. This is going to be where the rubber's going to meet the road here is when the State Water Resources Control Board has to consider relaxing environmental standards in the Delta to meet export demand. This is where that tug of war is going to be, and that will be nasty and brutish.
and not necessarily short, since you're quoting Hobbes.
That's right.
Let me get another caller. Mike, that's you. Hi.
Hi. It's kind of a two-part question. One, how much are we relying on groundwater? and has to switch from septic tanks to water treatment plants that then dump into the bay, affected our groundwater supply.
Another important question. Jeff, you want to take it?
Well, so it's a large, complicated answer to your question. It really is specific to locations. So in the Bay Area, you're right, the switch over to water treatment plants is basically moving more of the water into the bay. The bay actually does a lousy job of recycling and reusing its wastewater, and that's just been a problem compared to Southern California, for example. But the groundwater is going to be the big issue in this drought, and that is when we get out to the Central Valley where we're in great overdraft.
We've got seconds left here, but it brings up desalination. I mean, in fact, I'm looking at an email from a listener named Linda who says, what about desalination? What about putting such a plant in an area like Richmond, which is right on the water, create a plant which will provide jobs and water?
It's a really simple answer. It's very expensive and very difficult to permit. You need only look at what's happening in Southern California, and it's not going to solve any problems in the drought.
Well, we hope we can solve some of those problems. We certainly appreciate the expertise we've had here this morning from you, Jeff Mann. And again, Jeff Mann is Emeritus Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis, founding director of UC Davis's Center for Watershed Sciences. Thank you for spending this hour with us in studio.
My pleasure.
And thanks to Chris Brown, who is with us from Sacramento by ISDN, director of California Urban Water Conservation Council. Good to have you with us, Chris.
Yeah, thank you.
And we also thank our other guests, Karen Ross, Secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture, and Shauna Lorenz, General Manager of the San Juan Water District. We also had Richard Harris with us from East Bay Mud. And thank you for being with us. We are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can also, of course, let us know what you think by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. Again, our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And another hour of Forum coming up. We're going to talk about a new HBO series called Looking. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai. Senior editor Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.